Accession number 26562, reel number 7, Mr. Ken Taylor, reel number 17. Now, you were telling me about how you got to this point, which was North Ice, and you just had the airdrop, and then the commando came. There's just the six of you still. Or have the others joined you?
No, the six was, while the airdrop, so there were six, was three were going back, Lehman three, but they were there for the airdrop. Now, the airdrop's going on for days and days. I mean, it's not just one airdrop. I mean, they dropped 90 tons of stores. So that's a lot. I was in the tent with the radio, and the commander was stood outside, and they'd marked out, you know, where they wanted the aircraft to drop. And this particular day, and I don't remember the date now, it was in September sometime, he said, "Are you in touch with the aircraft?" And I said, "Yes, I've just been talking to the radio operator." He said, "Give him a call again." So I did give him a call again. There was no answer. And through all the snow and the mist and that sort of thing, they saw it was on the ground. It had crashed. And this was Hastings number 492. Flight Lieutenant Mike Clancy, as I recall. And what had happened, they were doing a free drop, which is very, very low. And to start with, it's like being inside a ping pong ball because there's no horizon. And they think that also the downdraft from the aircraft's propellers had stirred up the snow. And he completely lost his sort of bearings. And he banked too soon before he gained enough height. And the wingtip caught the ground and spun him completely round. And of course, this was, you know, a bit away from us because we didn't want them dropping on top of us, you see. So with that, they spotted the aircraft and sledged over there, saw it, and we moved our tents then from where we were over to the aircraft, which might have been a mile away, something like that sort of thing, half mile, mile, I don't know exactly, but so that we were alongside the aircraft. The radio operator had broken his nose when he aircraft, it had gone forward and did his I think it was Major Barker Simpson, who was the officer in charge of the airdrop. He'd broken an ankle, I think. And then there was an American major. Actually, they invited him out for the trip because he was the bloke in charge of the base, and he ended up being plopped down.
And Mike Clancy, was he all right?
Yeah.
So they were all right?
No one was killed, but I mean, there were some injuries. But if you see the control column on a Hastings, I mean, apart from the sort of wheel he's got there, he's got a stick down there, and I mean, it's about this wide. He bent it right over in trying to pull the aircraft round, because he was a big fella, big Irish fella, Mike Clancy. So what we did then, I mean, first thing I did was to start sending an SOS. And I thought, you know, this little radio, an American airbase was, oh, I don't know, could be 400 miles away. And per the Army's regulations, this radio has got a range of about 10-15 miles. And I started sending SOS, because there's no good sending it to our base in Britannia Lake, because we had a schedule with him in the evening, so he wouldn't have been listening. And he must have been working on his radio back to England or something, you see, and doing other things. So I sent SOSs, and this was picked up by the Americans in Tula, and reported it. And then, of course, when I got through Britannia Lake, the base later, told them, so they were able to pull back to London. But what we did then, I took my radio, because we moved the tents over to be by the aircraft, or near the aircraft, because of the fuel in the wings. I set up the radio in the tail, right down in the after end, because I needed to get medical advice for treating those that were injured. And then we took all the parachutes out of the aircraft and draped them around inside to make it like an installation, make a tent for them inside the aircraft, and because they had sleeping bags and what have you there. And then they had to sort of organise. Now, what they planned to do was they were getting a chappie from America, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I think his name was Bernt Bakken. He was a Norwegian-American who was an expert in Arctic-type flying. And he'd come out on a ski-wheeled, I think it was a Dakota. And they put JATO bottles on, strapped JATO bottles to the wing. But I mean, you had to get him from the States over to Greenland and then from there over, so it took a while. In the meantime, they're still carrying on their airdrops, still doing their airdrops. He landed to take off the injured ones first, and then they were going to take off. They brought a flying boat out, an American flying boat. I remember this is most fantastic. He came out. Now, the Americans will not fly over the ice cap without 24 hours of weather reports every 3 hours. So you imagine, I was on my knees. You know, you don't get much sleep when you sort of got to code up the Met report and send it off. And then the weather would change, that sort of thing. But anyway, finally, they sent this flying boat out, and this chap, a flying boat on the ice cap, he came in, and because you know the bottom of the flying boat's a bit like a ship with a bit of a keel to it, sort of. He flew down and made a groove along in the surface of the because it's hard packed snow on the top of the ice. He went round three times, made that groove wider, and then landed in the groove he made, which was quite fantastic. And they took off the rest of them, took them back. Then when we got all the stores out, we didn't collect all the stores because we were getting to that period when the weather started closing in and getting a bit darker. The main thing was to get the hut up before the other because the other three had to sledge all the way back to Britannia Lake again.
So which three were staying with you? You stayed.
I was there with Graham Rollitt. He was a naval lieutenant. He was a meteorologist. He was an ex-flyer, actually. But when they didn't want flyers after the war, he recategorised as a Met officer. And Pete Taylor, who was a glaciologist.
So just the three of you were left in the hut?
Yeah. Now, before the others went back, we had to build the hut.
Was that difficult?
No, quite straightforward. But basically, the first thing they did was to dig a square in the surface of about, I suppose, 2'6" deep, to put the base in, then put the side. And this was all prefabricated stuff. Had very tall ventilator and very tall chimney because we had a little Calagas stove for cooking. And because we had a cylinder Calagas stove for cooking and a little oil stove. The oil stoves, I think, were very pure diesel because we had them in the base as well. Just the diesel went into a tray, which lit, and you got the heat from it. But in that small hut, and I don't remember the size, and about could only have been about 12 foot by 12 foot. We had our bunks, a dining table, workbench and lab sort of thing, the cooking facilities, and once we got that done, the other side on the way back, we could gather in. We knew where a lot of the stuff had dropped, and you could still see the pallet because it was all with all the snow constantly drifting and it was getting covered up. So we actually waited the following spring. I collected some of my 12 volt batteries the following spring, and because the snow kept them warm, they were still functional. Quite amazing. And because we had to rig a wind generator,
Now tell me about that.
We had Dexin, it's like a grown up's Meccano, isn't it? This Dexin. We used to use that for making workbenches and things like that. But with wood from packing cases and Dexin, we built a tower, which was, I think the meteorologist said, that when you take wind measurements, they have to be 10 metres above the surface. I think that's the correct time, something like 10 metres, about 30 foot above the surface. So what we did, we built this Dexian and wood tower. We just sort of used the wood so we could build. And then on that we had our wind generator, and we had an anemometer for the weather, sort of wind. The wind generator, they weren't all that clever.
So a ready package wind generator. I mean, yeah. You didn't build it. I mean, you just erected it.
We erected it, and the thing was that when the wind got above a certain speed, it had a tail with a fin on, and it used to fold in half. It used to fold like that, which would swing out the wind. And then it would swing back in the wind again, and the wind got up and it swing. But this tail kept snapping back and forth, and it weakened it, snapped it. The other thing, which was the bane of my life, was the fact Lucas provided these. They had one in the base as well. Lucas provided these for us to do trials on. And they provided several different types of propeller. Some were made of metal and some were made of a composite material. Had slightly different aerofoils. They wanted to see which was the best.
So for the wind generator?
Yeah, for the wind generator. Which meant you've got to climb this tower in the freezing cold and take the propeller off, then use it for a few weeks and test it. And they tried to charge us for these when we came back. After we'd done all these reports from the wind generator, they tried to everybody else gave their stuff free, because we did reports. So I've never, whenever I've got a car and I've got anything Lucas on it, I look at it with hatred. Because I think they were tight.
Now, you were setting this up and winter's coming. Now, what were you three going to be doing during the winter?
Meteorology, obviously. The glaciologist, he can't do much. But the hut got completely snowed on, though. You couldn't see it. All you can see is the chimney and the air vent sticking out the top. What we did do, on these, a lot of aircraft, the Hastings aircraft, they've got a dome where the navigator gets up there with his theodolite thing, I can't think of the name of it now, and does his star sights, you see. We took this off the aircraft and we put it on. Because we had a little hatch which could open on the roof, or the roof got covered over. And we had a lot of stuff like Bostik and that sort of thing, Bostik compound, and we stuck this through so we could, when it was daylight, get some light through the roof with this little dome thing, see?
So could you go out at all?
I went out one morning. I mean, we're supposed to take weather reports every 3 hours, but because of the the wear and tear on us, really. We didn't do one at 3 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the winter. And I went out at 9 o'clock. I think it was 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock, to take the temperature. Now, the amazing thing is, all the instruments are in the Stevenson screen, the normal Stevenson screen. And you had to take a torch out, it was pitch black. And you'd lift the lid of the Stevenson screen, and you wouldn't shine the torch in because of the heat from the ray. You'd shine the torch up in the air or down on the ground just to give you light. But even then, you got all this clothing on and you had your windproof jacket. You'd lift that lid up and the thermometer was across that way. And you'd see that mercury racing up from the heat from your body through all your clothing. So you had to be very quick, take snap readings. And you got used to exactly roughly where the temperature was going to be. So you could take a quick snap reading of it. And at 9 o'clock on February morning, I measured minus 82.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So it must have been a lot colder than that at 3 o'clock when I went to 6 o'clock.
Now, what was the, so that was your job taking?
Well, the meteorologist there as well. I mean, but because we take it in turns, because I was learning as well, and I mean, I had to be awake anyway to send it off on the radio, because all these. Met reports went to one main station in the south of Greenland, who sent them off, to other states. So all over the world, they collate all these weather reports.
Now, what else were you doing?
I'm doing communications all the time. I say the hut got buried, so we dug a tunnel outside the door because we were completely underground. We dug tunnels and we were digging in the ice, it's hard packed snow more there and ice, and we were building rooms underground. In actual fact, to get to the hut, we went along the tunnel, we took a little ladder out of the aircraft, and we'd go up, and we had a little hole to go through to get out, and it was like a little igloo sort of cover, and we used to crawl out there through that hole. Now, one of the things I did...
So you actually had rooms and tunnels in the snow?
In the snow. And the people that relieved us, because we were up there 9 months, and then I went back, and Dixie Dean came up to relieve me on the pond, on the ice cap, and I went back to the base after 9 months. And that they dug even more little caves and hideouts under the snow. But one of the things I did, I took some of the radio equipment out of the aircraft, so it was handy if you needed to use it, you know, so if any valves had broken in. And I also started taking out some of the Dural control rods. And I was sawing these out of the aircraft. And what I did, I made myself a DF loop with a pole going up through. And so when the weasels were due to come, because we ended up having all, you know, stocks of food, stocks of fuel, and that sort of thing, for the weasels, and to help them sort of find us, I made a DF aerial, so I could
direction finding
now, so I could, you know, made it out of, it's only crude, but it worked effectively. But also what we did, once the spring came and the light came back, we sledged, and when I say sled, we had a manhole sledge, something to pull. We got some of these packing cases and made signposts, and we went for about half a mile north, every so often putting one of these up, say north ice that away, and we went a mile and a half. Now, it made me realise manhauling a sledge. Now, we were only manhauling a few bits of wood, and then, you know, and a mallet hammer them in. Absolutely gut-wrenching job, manhauling a sledge. And when I thought about Captain Scott and his boats pulling those sledges all the way to the South Pole with all the weight they had on them, because there's no doubt, and because up you're at 10,000 feet.
Why couldn't you use the Husky? You sent the Huskies
back. Oh, they'd all gone back. We were just on our own then.
So you had to manhaul it.
Oh, man.
And it was physically exhausting.
Physically exhausting, I mean, and because we're at 10,000 feet as well, so this is where it's hard. But, I mean, we're just going out, putting up a few signs. And also you're doing, you know, you're cooking as well. You've got to do your cooking.
Well, take me through a typical day. What was a typical day like? And what was it like with the night? With it always being... Because it made me better. It's a typical night when there's no light.
Yeah. I mean...
What would a typical day be like for you?
Well, I had to send weather reports basically every 3 hours. So, you know, that kept me busy to start with. Then you've got to take it in turns to do your cooking. The meteorologist, all I know, he had a hydrogen generator to make hydrogen for his Met balloons. And because we set this up in one of the areas we dug out in the underground. So when the light came back, we got everything ready so he could send up balloons and you know, do wind measurements and that sort of thing. Glaciologist, he was, you know, he could go boring down, because if we had these tunnels, he could go boring down taking samples of snow at different depths, and they could tell sort of how many years, as you know, whether that was a dirty year for muck and that sort of thing, doing all sorts of things.
And you'd help each other?
Oh, yeah.
How did you get on with the other two?
I always thought that three was a very sensible number, because I thought afterwards, if we'd had four, we could have got to the stage where two ganged up on the other two, you know, got Pally, and the other two got Pally. By three of us, you know, obviously people had moods. If you was in a bit of a mood, the other two would sense it, leave you alone. So they had a pal each. You see, and we never had a single argument all the time we were up there. Not one
no stress on it.
No, not one crossword amongst us. And it worked out well, because, you know, if you saw the other one was in a bit of a mood, because we all have our biorhythms, don't we? And the other two could sort of, you know, perhaps say to him, you know, leave him alone, he's got a weed on.
And what did you do for recreation, for fun? Or was there none?
Oh, we chatted. And the trouble was, Mike Banks, the Captain of Marines, he was a part of many other things because he was in charge of the Sizewick Weasel team. He was the, what should we say, the welfare officer, and he organised record player. We had records, and record player was all dropped down, and we had one in the base. He had booze in the base because he made an arrangement with Lamb's rum. We had overproof rum because it was exported out. They had scotch and various things.
Would you drink much?
He forgot about the ice cap, so we hadn't got a drop. Our first Christmas was stone dry. We didn't have a drop of drink at all, and he apologised profusely for it.
I mean, but when you had it, did you drink much? I mean,
No. I could have some rum every night because the overproof rum, most people couldn't take it. And when I was back in the base hut, most evenings I was doing propagation research. Like,
I'll come back to the base hut, yeah.
So I would have a drink then when I was in the base hut.
And did you get bored when you were on the ice cap?
No.
Because you were there long, what, 6 months?
9 months. We used to... and we did little things like we rigged up a light outside, running from in the hut, up on the air vent, because if someone went out to read the weather and then there was a blizzard on, you could lose your way, not find your way back to the hut, you see. So we had this light, we put the light on so you at least had the light glowing in. We had to get ready for... the Americans decided, being very generous people, they decided they'd give us a Christmas airdrop. And being terrible navigators, they never found us. And they wanted a weather report every 3 hours. And I had to send a weather report every 3 hours, and I was on my knees.
I thought you said you missed out the night one.
Well, for the Americans, but just for them, I had to send one to their base every 3 hours because they would not fly over that ice cap without 24 hours weather beforehand.
When you needed the Americans to drop something,
I didn't need it. They were volunteering. We didn't ask for it, but they, you know, because they're very generous people, the Americans, always have been. And because it was Christmas and they knew we were there and that, you know, our planes had operated from their base, they were going to give us a Christmas airdrop.
And then you never got it.
We got it eventually, but I mean, I'd send 24 hours reports, and all of a sudden the last one wasn't very good, so they cancelled it. I went another 24 hours report, another 24 hours report, and I was on my knees. And finally, we got the drop. And they also there was a Met station on the northwest coast of Greenland. They were on the coast with a coastline shaped coastline. And the bloke I used to communicate with up there, a chap called Sorensen, was a warrant officer in the Norwegian Navy. And funny enough, I met him at the signal school years later when he came over for a course. But he said they promised them an airdrop, and he said they couldn't find them. And he said, we're on the coast. He said, you've only got to get to the coast and follow the lines of the coast, you see. And what we did, and it was pitch black, we had all these jerry cans with this fuel in. It'd been used by, you know, and we... cut them down in half, and we laid them out in a cross, which each leg was a quarter of a mile long. We filled them with petrol, and when they were on their way to do the airdrop, we lit this, so you had a cross, which was in a completely black situation, flaming away, and they couldn't see, don't know where they were. Because the amazing thing was, when they came out to rescue those, something I didn't mention, when they came out to rescue those wounded people from the airdrop, they had a plane which was stripped of everything. It was a big sort of bomber-type plane or passenger plane. Had nothing but navigation and electronic equipment on. And they were going to guide this burnt back and out with this little ski-wheeled plane. And they couldn't find us. And we'd call them on the radio, this and that. They could not find us. And the Hastings aircraft of Transport Command, which after all said and done, are the truck drivers of the Royal Air Force, aren't they? Led this electronic wizardry out to show them the way. And after this Hastings crashed, I checked his navigation equipment, and apart from the crude radar they had on there, which wasn't all that modern, the navigator, his charts, they're just blank because there's nothing there but white, so it's only just got longitude and latitude on it, you know, and just white. He had a little 4-inch stub of a pencil, a 6-inch ruler, and a pair of dividers, and I've still got the dividers out there, and they used to lead the Americans. Anyway, they finally made it, and they dropped loads of magazines, and there was apples, and of course, they're frozen. They were like billiard balls, and you could knock them together, clonk, 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 and it took ages for them to thaw out at a magazine, and they were very good. I mean, they were all little goodies and that sort of thing. They were very generous of them, but I thought, wish they forget the idea of being kind to us.
Now, anything else happened during that 9 months, or was it fairly well a routine?
Fairly well a routine. I mean, once the lights started coming back, we started going out searching for the stuff we hadn't collected from the airdrop. And it's amazing how you think it's over there so far, and when the scenery's changed and all the snow's been blown across, and I was convinced there was a certain package. And what I did, I didn't realise what they were, but on this aircraft, they've got Benzedrine tablets. And I took a Benzedrine tablet, and I wasn't aware that it had given me energy. And I dug holes everywhere looking for this thing. And when I look back in retrospect, I must have gone mad. I was digging down about 6 feet, nothing there. Can't be any deeper than that. Go over there, dig 6 feet. And I was digging holes all over the ice cap looking for this, and when it wore off, I was absolutely whacked. But I didn't realise. I never felt I had that extra energy. But
is that the only time you took them, the Benzedrine?
Yeah. I just thought I'd take these when I go out digging. But
So how did it all come to an end? I mean, is there a thaw? I mean, you're under
10,000 feet of ice. If there's a thaw, you've got a long drop.
Well, what I mean is, your hut is below. I mean. Does it ever come back on, or is it just gets deeper and deeper?
It's deeper and deeper, yeah.
So there's no thawing at all?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Where we stuck these wood markers, the radiation from the sun off the wood onto the snow, there would be a little dip where it melted it. Just the radiation from the sun on the wood.
Other than that, so your hut would gradually sink below ground.
Well, I suppose there's
not sink. I mean, the ground would level, would just the ice.
Yeah, but it wouldn't go that high because there's nothing else to stop it. Would just blow over it. I mean, it was covered, but I don't think it would keep going up because it just doesn't pile up, does it?
I see what you mean. So it was drifting against it, right?
Yeah, drifting against it and over it, but then it wouldn't completely cover it.